drag finally made it mainstream when RuPaul appeared on The Simpsons. On episode Workin' Mom, Marge becomes a drag queen to sell food containers and discovers that drag can be empowering. Although we didn't quite get Rue embracing a cis woman as the queen that she is, Homer declared, "These days, everyone can be everything."
Since RuPaul's Drag Race came on the air a decade ago, the world of drag has changed. The lines between gender, identity, and sexuality have all blurred, and most drag shows these days welcome anyone who's got a dollar to tip a queen. TV just hasn't caught up. Today, trans guy drag queen Sweet Gwendolyn, also known as Debbie Penetration, joins us to take a look at the roller coaster ride drag has gone through in the past decade, and how a lot of ideas from performance art, like therapy, breaking barriers, and doing wild stuff for kicks, got folded into the drag souffle.
Listen as Sweet Gwendolyn chats with us about some of the highlights of the Austin International Drag Festival and the challenges of doing drag when you're disabled.
Plus, Sweet Gwendolyn's erotic art history collection on Tumblr.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Become a member and support this show at feastoffun.com/plus.
Hello.
Is this Sweet Gwendolyn?
Why, yes, it is.
Oh, a.k.a. Debbie Penetration.
The one and only from Austin, Texas.
How are you? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
I'm doing well. It was so nice to meet you when we've been in Texas before and find out you're a long-term listener of the podcast. And it's always sweet
Yes. When
we get a chance to connect with the listeners on the podcast, on the actual podcast.
Right. I have been listening to just about every episode of the podcast. In fact, right now is like our 3-year anniversary because we met at the drag festival 3 years ago when Fausto photobombed himself into a picture he was taking of us. And someone told me that that's who you were. And I found the podcast and I've been listening ever since.
Aww. Really? So my rude act of photobombing actually
Yes.
did some good.
It did. I was so annoyed when you did it too. But
I'm so sorry.
You looked so it was such a funny photo once I got to look at it. So I actually posted it. And I'm like, here's some guy who photobombed himself into our picture. And Mandy Quinn was like, oh, that's Fausto Fernos from Feast of Fun. You might really like that show.
But for the record, though, I did make sure you
yes,
guys got
you
the
did.
Photo you needed.
You
too.
Did. Right. It was a group drag queen show. Yeah.
No, were you not in drag then, Fausto?
I was not in drag.
No.
And they were like, girls club only.
Well, but yeah, so you did turn around and you you did a one for real afterwards. And so that was a good one as well.
Well, I do notice that with like some artists that are really well established and they find themselves in situations inevitably that someone doesn't know who they are or whatever. And uh-huh. They're used to having their photo taken. And thankfully for Mark and I, like our career goes up and down. And there are times where we're like, have that experience. And other times when we can't get arrested. I always just want to have fun and connect
right.
with people. And that's, why we do this show. And certainly, uh-huh. Drag's changing a lot. When we first uh-huh. started in this podcast 14 years ago, we're into our 15th uh-huh. year mm-hmm. this
coming up
spring,
next season. Yeah.
Is, people were asking us strange questions like,
why would you interview a drag queen? Why would you talk to drag queens? Why do you care about drag queens? They were truly in awe. They didn't get it. They didn't understand it. But then uh-huh. a little TV show called RuPaul's Drag Race and RuPaul's
right?
Drag Race All-Stars and RuPaul's Drag You and
Ruined
RuPaul's
it.
Christmas Special
yeah.
made people aware. They're just like, oh, my God, drag is legitimate. Art form, a legitimate form
right.
of expression.
Well, it's always been a legitimate art form for me. And
right.
and we started.
Well, we recognize that, yes.
When I was a itty bitty teenager in Austin, Texas. And
uh-huh.
Austin, Texas is a really great community because it's surrounded by a very conservative part of the South. And at the same time, you have this university and this music scene and this creative scene. And it's just this perfect melting spot for political tension, art, and glitter.
Well, also the way I would put it is that you hear about other places that suffer brain drain. Well, the inverse of that is that Austin's a brain magnet, because every single, you know, misfit and weirdo who couldn't, you know, blend in to save their lives moved to Austin. And this is a 7-day a week drag town. And I don't even mean like there's one show each day of the week. I mean, there are multiple shows most days of the week. I think we have to be one of the most drag intense cities in the entire country.
You know, and it breaks my heart to hear you say that, because when I moved out of Austin, Texas, people were like, there are not going to be any more drag shows.
Aww.
It was like, and I was like, hello. I just want to do a shout out to Charlie's at the time. And there was a drag queen who I'm blanking out her name because I'm on NyQuil right now. But,
four of us.
What was her? She was Jamie Perry.
Jamie Perry, who's still
Jamie Perry!
Who you thought was dead.
Well, I went up. So I was doing a cable access show under the name Faustina, which is basically the same podcast, only with beautiful blonde hair and a thick Puerto Rican accent. Because it allowed me to get away with stuttering and not be able to form sentences and stuff. And it worked. And people had a lot of fun. And I was a huge fan of Jamie Perry. And I wanted to invite her to come do the show with me. Jamie Perry is a strong black woman who was known for doing a very dynamic cover, you know, lip sync performance of "If You Could Read My Mind, Love" by Ultra Nate, the Gordon Lightfoot cover that was in the film Studio 54. And her signature move was having a nuclear explosion coming out as a sound, and she would enter the stage.
Ooh.
And she was just
a dramatic,
wonderful performer. She's what, when we think about drag queens on Drag Race today, she was that. She was, and she probably still is. And so she disappeared for years and years and years and years. And one day, not too long ago, I was at Charlie's before they closed. It was a gay bar in Austin, Texas. And I went up to her and I was like, "Are you Jamie Perry?" And she's like, "Yes, it is, honey. Fausto, how are you?"
And she remembered you?
She remembered me.
And, even though you have like 50 pounds of muscle on you now?
Well, you know, because I did that cable access show, that you know, which in hindsight was another big mistake to stop to leave. But so I was just flabbergasted. I said to her, I was like, "I feel like I'm talking to a ghost because you just disappeared for like 20 years. And she's like, "Oh, girl, I was transitioning."
Well, great.
And that's the thing about RuPaul's Drag Race, is this show, this juggernaut, has made drag mainstream. And I think I can point to the date and the time and the location was last Sunday on The Simpsons. It was RuPaul and Raja on an episode where Marge Simpson, she wanted to become a Tupperware salesperson. And was not
Tupperware.
Very good at Tupperware. And her gay friend decided to trick her into dressing up as a drag queen. And his gay friends loved her, and she made lots of money. And that led somehow for Marge Simpson to be cast on the very RuPaul's Drag Race-shaped stage in a show by a drag queen that was voiced by RuPaul.
Right.
And the consequence of the show is inevitably Homer gets jealous and ruins it for everybody, and saves the day by dressing up in drag himself. And they have this wonderful transcendent moment on stage where they're dancing on the stage of RuPaul's Drag Race, right? So, and Marge turns to RuPaul and says, "You know, I've been deceiving you guys. I was not really a drag queen." And RuPaul said, "Oh, honey, we knew all along."
Right.
And that's been a big point of contention.
To interpretation.
As the world of television
right?
has changed, the world outside of television I'm sorry, as the world of television has not changed, the world outside of television has really, really gone through a profound change.
Well, I think it's important to say that March is like, I'm not really a drag queen, right? It's how she, is, that's how she faced
it.
Right.
It was ambiguous. And then RuPaul's she never said the word real. She said, I was deceiving you because I was not one of you guys. And RuPaul, sort of in an indirectly way, said, even though we knew you were fooling us, you're still part of us.
Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't get that out of that at all.
Some trans people and some drag queens are criticizing that because they're saying that's not what, you know, it's an ambiguous line. It's meant,
If anything, I thought it was sort of negative. And just to back up for a minute for people who are wondering what my stake in all this is, I am a trans guy who is a drag queen, but I am not on hormones. And so it's, I'll back up and say, I also don't really care that much. I think everyone obviously should be able to be on RuPaul's Drag Race, but I just can't get emotionally invested in the politics of this one episode. Mm-hmm. But what I thought was, I thought it seemed kind of negative because she's saying like, oh, I was tricking you all along. I'm not really a drag queen. He's saying, oh, I know you're not a drag queen. I mean, he was invalidating her being a drag queen. And I didn't see anything about.
She didn't say that. She said, we knew all along.
Right. We knew all along that you weren't really a drag queen. But I would say if she's in drag and she's performing on a stage, that's a drag queen.
It was a missed opportunity for RuPaul to say, hey, Marge, we're all born naked and the rest is drag.
Right.
You know, her iconic line, it would have fit so well. And it kind of, this one just kind of like you say, it kind of in some ways it landed like a lead balloon. It's not really
ambiguous.
It was ambiguous, but also leaning more towards the whole, like, we don't want women on Drag Race or whether they're trans or identify as
ambiguous
female as birth,
leading
right?
towards the negative.
Yeah.
So then at the end of the episode, Homer turns Mo, the bartender, turns to Homer and says, so are you a drag queen now? And Homer goes, I guess everyone these days can be everything. And I think that was a very powerful statement to make.
That should have been
ambiguous.
RuPaul's line.
That should have been. But then what is Homer going to say?
Homer's the smart one.
Right.
Because that's kind of in many ways is been your experience. You know, you were assigned female at birth. You identify as male. You in sense transitioned, even though you're not medically transitioning.
I'm socially transitioned. Mm-hmm.
And it's because, you know, it's the gender is what's in your brain, right? It's not your body.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right. I was just going to clarify for people listening that I medically am not able to transition. It's probably never going to be on the table for me. And I used to always say it probably wouldn't be right for me anyway. I feel like as time goes on, part of me wonders. I don't think I'd ever want to just like 100% transition, but I could definitely see wanting to take some hormones just to, you know, because I do.
And you don't surprisingly, do that because of health reasons.
Medically, I have a medical condition that sort of prevents my being able to take hormones. Mm-hmm. And I actually did like really briefly take a very low dose of testosterone and it went really badly for me.
Oh,
and
sorry
I just
to hear that.
Decided, it didn't even last 3 weeks. And so anyway, I was kind of just sticking a pinky toe in the water. And I think, you know, maybe, it's sort of like a thought exercise because it doesn't even matter because it doesn't apply to me. But I wouldn't necessarily mind sharpening up my features a little because I do get sirred, actually, not a ton, but some, you know, by strangers. And
you get what?
So it might be sirred, like, you know, hello, sir, you know, pardon me, sir, that sort of thing. And so it would be nice, honestly, when that happens, it feels great. And it would be nice if I got a little more of that. But on the whole, I don't care that much.
You have breasts, you wear a lot of makeup.
Right.
When
I'm in drag, I wear a lot of makeup. But you've only seen me in drag.
I asked you to send me photos of you in your butch look, and all of them you're wearing lipstick and mascara.
Yeah, so I identify as a very high glam gender fuck guy. And I honestly, here's the thing. I feel like I look more like a guy in drag makeup than I do without it for several reasons. One is my facial features that I'm born with are just highly feminine. So if I try to do something like, you know, put on a fake mustache, I literally look like a woman who is wearing a fake mustache. And that's so much more dysphoric to me, you know, to try and fail. And on the flip side is, I mean, at least in my mind, which is really, I'm the only audience that counts as far as gender dysphoria goes. But in my mind, when I am in female presenting drag, I look like an assigned male person who is in female presenting drag. And I feel like it's just, at a minimum, it's dramatically more genderfuck to be in drag. And it's sort of how I do it is when I am, you know, just like when I go out to attend a show, and I usually put on my drag makeup. You know, I'm going to be seen by my community, my peers and all that. I put on my drag makeup, but I use my own hair, which for people
that's
who do not know me,
not
usually
true. I have a photograph of you wearing this gorgeous wig we took last Christmas.
Well, that was new. That was like the right. We were going out to a holiday party, like between Christmas and New Year's.
Sweet Gwendolyn, I have receipts. You were wearing pantyhose on January 31st.
Right. But my hair in general is, like, I keep it shaved and I stencil black stars on, like, a fuchsia or green or yellow or whatever background. So I can totally get away with drag makeup and not wearing a wig. So in general, no hard rules. When I go out presenting as myself, I wear the makeup in my own hair. But when I'm presenting myself like as a drag queen, as I was when the two of us went out, then I put on the wig. And that's like more of when I'm like Debbie Penetration, although it's not really a separate character. I don't do anything.
But do your friends like call you Debbie Penetration? Because I did notice a lot of people going, hey, sweet, what's up?
Right. Right. I always tell people, unless you are the MC of a drag show that is just about to introduce me to the stage, just call me Gwendolyn. Just because I perform so much as Sweet Gwendolyn also, I'm a queer storyteller. We have a showcase called Greetings from Queer Mountain here, which is amazing. It is one of the best things I've ever been to. It's coming up on 6 years, and it's a queer storytelling showcase, and they have like a topic per show, and people get up and talk for about 8 minutes, and it skews heavily towards humorous personal narrative. But, you know, there are some people who get up and just treat it like a straight up stand up comedy routine, and other people who get up and tell the most heartbreaking stories you've ever heard, and which are like honestly some of the best pieces. And I've done all three of those things up there. And so I perform there as Sweet Gwendolyn. I'm also a queer and transgender erotic art historian, and I do I have like a Tumblr with like hundreds of
fully researched.
Hold on a second, you're going to give us a lot to unpack.
But
here.
Anyway, go.
This is not a job interview.
Right, but when I do drag, it's as Debbie Penetration. Yeah. So
I want to talk about your drag performance because, you know, for a lot of people, drag is about transforming into something, an idealized version of yourself,
a
ridiculous
creature of your own imagination.
Yeah.
That's what Paul says.
Great. Now, I'm literally living in a world that's like.
She copped that line from Fausto.
She stole that line from me. It was like, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know what world I live in now. It's like, maybe I'm RuPaul. But anyways, so people are like, what are you talking about? So in the second Kickstarter for Cooking with Drag Queens, we appropriated Dustin Lance Black's speech of the Oscars for winning the award for Harvey Milk, calling the audience, you are all beautiful creatures. Mm. And I thought that was kind of like spooky and kooky and weird, especially for somebody who's, you know, pretty mainstream, right? The Oscars, a screenwriter.
Sure.
And I said, well, I guess a drag queen is anyone who transforms themselves into a beautiful creature. But here's the catch of your own imagination. Mm-hmm. It has to come from you.
Uh-huh.
Well, are you saying somebody that rips off Trixie Mattel's look and act like almost completely, is that not a drag queen then?
Well, if you're dreaming about being Trixie Mattel, that is still your imagination,
isn't
it?
That's true.
You know, and sometimes I do dream that I'm Trixie Mattel.
Do you? How many dicks do you suck when you're when you? Think
I just go around borrowing money. No, but it's anyway. And I think that at the core of drag, especially in other cultures, transforming is the key word there. For you, what is this idealized version of yourself that you're creating?
I just really like the way I look, and I like the performance art aspect because I'm definitely a concept queen. I haven't even mentioned to our listeners that I'm disabled. I spend most of my life in bed, but I'm well enough that I can get up and, you know, do stuff and everything. It's just, you know, I have to put a lot of effort into it. And so I'm never going to be like a dancing queen. And so I had to come up with something to, you know, occupy the time on the stage. And so I started coming up with, and honestly, my favorite drag routines anyway have like just a little thread of a storyline to them or something like that.
Well, when we hear people saying disability, they usually think wheelchair or but right. Disability no, can be a wide variety of
yes.
of yeah, circumstances. And most people look at me and
they have no idea that I'm disabled, except for that I mention it a lot and it gets in the way of my doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Sometimes,
so are you like vegan you know, the vegans love to tell you they're vegan?
Oh, actually, I'm more like that with being a trans guy because since I'm not on hormones, I have to tell everyone that I'm a trans guy drag queen all the time.
I introduced Sweet Gwendolyn to my family last uh-huh. Christmas. And within the first 5 minutes, Sweet was talking about being disabled, being trans, being a drag uh-huh. queen. And
got to get it out there.
My right. mother got it, but my sisters were like, their heads were spinning.
Mm-hmm. Your mom's seen a lot. Very lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just need, well, you know, eventually you just be like, hey, listen to this podcast. I do explain it all. Or maybe you just right. print up, you have little pamphlets. Here you go.
You know, like somebody who's like handing cards and says, I am deaf, mm-hmm. so I cannot hear you. You know.
I remember you guys talking on the show about how on many levels being queer is a lifelong exercise and having to constantly out yourself mm-hmm. again and again, and how when you do like podcasts or conventions, people, you always have to like explain that you're married because they assume that you're just like a team who works together. Mm-hmm. And it's like that for being trans. And so, I mean, I really only do it for people who I expect to know socially. I don't bother telling the, you know, waiter who's bringing me my sandwich or whatever. But yeah, anyone who I think that I am going to continue to know in the future, I usually like to clarify that I'm trans. I mean, it's not the first thing I say, but I think we all just want to be understood.
Sure. And your preferred pronoun is bro?
No. No, I you know, that's honestly a fraught question for me. I'm still trying to figure out because, I mean, as a drag queen, people are going to call me she and her as Debbie Penetration, just like they would any other guy who sure. is dressing up in drag. And so I'm really desensitized to she, her. It doesn't faze me. And with they, them, I you know, it's like, who? They who? And, you know, I mean, it's I eventually figure it out and I appreciate the gesture, but I don't know. That always throws me a little and it takes my brain a minute to catch up. And I think that I actually haven't done this yet, but I think I am going to... there's a bunch of Leathermen. I go to a social once a month, and I think that I'm going to request that I go by he, him there, because I'm pansexual, but I really identify with queer Leathermen a lot. God. And it feels really good. Yeah. Well, that's my scene. I've been going for like 6 years, 5 or 6 years to this thing. They're great. I competed in their leather competition a few weeks ago, and it felt really good to be recognized as a fellow guy by all of my peers. So I think I might request that when I'm at this social that I go by he, him, and then if that feels really good and it seems manageable, then probably expand from there.
And the reason we talk about RuPaul's Drag Race is not because like, uh-huh. we're like drank the RuPaul's Drag Race Kool-Aid, or maybe we did,
right.
but because sometimes the conversation surrounding that show is really good at illustrating some of the crises we're facing uh-huh. as LGBT people as we move forward in consciousness and equality and awareness. And one of them is that's always been happening is that this idea and it stems sort of like it's a form of internalized oppression. A lot of young lesbians and young gay men, you know, to soft pedal coming out to their families, they say they're bisexual when they're not actually genuinely interested in both any other gender other than their own sexually. And then there are people out there who are pan, poly, bi, and are very interested in more than just one gender sexually.
Right.
And so, you know, and it's an unfair burden. And I noticed this trend happening also, and it's just been happening since we started, you know, doing the show, is trans women hurting each other. It's mostly coming from trans men, women, not necessarily trans men, that you're not a real trans person if you're not on hormone replacement therapy and in the process of getting some form of surgery.
Well, I would say there are plenty of trans guys who have that view, but
they do.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's more of a, I don't even know that it's necessarily a hard grained, like an ingrained bias for a lot of people. I think that's just what their understanding of what transgender is, because up until I think very recently when people started to be more open and coming out about it, you didn't know someone was trans unless they had gone for hormones and surgery. Sure. And, you know, it was a little more, you had the visual cue to pick up on it, that, you know, someone, you know, is starting to look a little different or something. And I think that as, you know, really people, trans visibility has just really exploded in the last, I mean, it's logarithmic. I mean, I say last 5 years, but I mean, more has happened in the last 1 or 2 years than, you know, the first couple of those. So the more we gain visibility, it puts a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily have mentioned it because maybe they don't have access to hormones or like me, they medically can't transition, or maybe, you know, just there's a lot of reasons not to transition. They're not in the right point in their life, or they're afraid of losing their very lucrative job that they're gonna, you know, only have for a few more years anyway.
I gotta tell you, when I'm in a workplace environment, I'm always very excited when somebody comes out as trans, because it challenges, you know, especially the company has non-discrimination policies in place, and it's just like a wrench of the works, you know. And I'm usually the one going around telling people, it's like, you know, calm down, you know, you need to you know, create an inviting, welcoming environment, because it's really not fair for trans people to have that burden all the time,
to have to do all the emotional labor. And yeah, absolutely, you are being a wonderful ally, and I would encourage anyone listening to the podcast, if someone in your proximity, in whatever circle, comes out as trans, to really try and go to bat for them and help educate people, because it is so much labor to have to educate everyone all the time. But I'm actually really lucky because let's just put it this way, that there are very, very few silver linings to being too disabled to work. One is I can do whatever I want with my hair, and the other one is I don't have to deal with anyone who I don't want to have to deal with. You know, I live full-time, 100% of my life in the queerosphere, you know, and so I am actually incredibly lucky that I'm just dealing with people who get it 100% of the time. I, you know, can tell people I am a trans guy, drag queen, and I'm not on hormones, and they're just like, cool, and like, there's no, huh, what, how does that work? Like, just everyone around me gets it, and they take it at face value, and no one challenges it. Like, I can't believe, honestly, the extent to which I've been able to just waltz through my life just with that explanation. And like, I don't feel like I experience any sort of discrimination or bias or any trouble getting booked.
Well, you live in a very welcoming environment, and it's also a place where
really
a lot
do.
Of artists, and it's people who are fulfilling their own dreams. And we talked about this yesterday with Heraclitus here, is like, you know, when you're on your own path, like, you can attract other people, and that's the kind of thing that's happening. And I remember talking to Alexander Billings before, and she says the thing about it, when people see a trans person and they have like a very negative reaction, most of the times they're looking at that trans person and saying, that person is being the person they want to be, but for whatever reason, I'm not being the person I want to be, and so I need to like attack them.
But that, the violence is magnified through the prism of transphobia and sexism and misogyny and racism and homophobia too, you know, because I mean, anytime I see a beautiful bodybuilder, a beautiful woman, I go, that should be me too, you know?
Yeah.
and part of it is like, you know, and I think that violence is stemming from this idea that this person is having more fun than you. And regressives share that in common. All regressives, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, because there's plenty everywhere, share three things in common. But the one thing is they don't like seeing other people have more fun than them. Mm-hmm. Or they see somebody else having a more expensive car than they do, or a nicer house, they get secretly mad about it. They're like, it's a weird selfishness, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're very fearful. Yeah. And then the third thing is they just get a lot of visceral pleasure about bossing people around. But at the same time, they think that's being a good leader or a good parent or a good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
leading by disapproval.
Yeah, and so, you know, like, I think that's what's been so great this past couple of years, you know, in our political, you know, apocalypse that we're in right now, is that we've really got a great illustration on how not to behave with each other. And in terms of, like, the shortcoming of, you know, television in serving LGBT people, you know, television is chock full of LGBT people, but they're completely out of touch with people on the street. You know, it's to me, it's kind of baffling, this weird.
Well, certainly Drag Race, I think, in terms of who they're willing to have on the show.
The concepts, the discussions, you know, like, I remember, like, growing up watching Arsenio Hall, and Diamanda Galaz was a guest on his show.
Wow.
You know, Andy Kaufman
was
on Saturday Night Live. Divine was a guest on David Letterman. You know, it's like, you know, counterculture isn't always been so much on the fringe. And so to me, it's really exciting to see a lot of the countercultural forces on television. Yet at the same time, I want to see Sweet Gwendolyn on TV.
Aww.
You know,
I'd love to be on TV. I'll get there eventually. I'm getting healthier. I should say I'm a disabled person, who is eventually going to make a full recovery. So right now, all of the art I do is really just for myself. I mean, I know a lot of people have, you know, drag saved my life stories, and they really literally mean it. And so do I. Like, when I started accessing drag, going to shows and quickly, you know, as soon as I could, you know, learning how to put on makeup, which, of course, I had never worn makeup prior to that because, you know, I was afraid people would mistake me for a girl. And
Marge, we could tell.
So wait, I lost my train of thought.
The drag saved your life. It gave you
a lot
of different physical
pain.
Struggles and gave you the power to overcome
it. I was in so
it.
Much physical pain. It was hard for me to, like, live. We live in such a there's a pill for that society that I don't think people have a real understanding that there are people who are in, like, abject, unbearable levels of physical suffering every single second of their lives. And I had to cope with being in that. And I know it sounds counterintuitive for someone who's that sick to be going out, much less being on a stage. But honestly, when I was on a stage, those would be the only 5 or 10 minutes of my entire month that I would not be thinking about how much pain I was in. And also going to shows, you know, I mean, you hit a certain, I think a lot of people, the what they have, their frame of reference for being disabled is the time they had the flu really bad and they can't, they, you know, badly, and they camped out on their couch for a week and a half or something. And it's just like, and when those weeks turn into months, turn into years, and you are suffering that badly for all of it, after a certain point, going out is, anything is better than just staring at your four walls and thinking about how much pain you are in. So I really didn't have the ability to go out much in the beginning, but as I started going out more and more, it was, I mean, it was very, very difficult, but it was the payoff for distracting myself and finding all this, you know, this wonderful world of glamour and costumes, which had always appealed to me so much, but I had I never felt welcome. I felt like I was chased out of every queer male space I ever tried to access. People were really cruel to me. I felt completely unwelcome in the queer community for most of my life. And then actually what happened was 6 years ago, you guys know who Christine is?
Oh, yeah.
C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-E, like a very...
How many licks does it take to fix my dick?
Well, you better get all you can of her in Austin because she's moving to New York City.
Oh, I know. She's having her going away show, but I always call her the high end of lowbrow because she is brilliant. She is so creative. She has more clever, filthy plays on words per capita than I've ever heard anywhere, and her videos are so amazing. Her stage show is performance art, and I made it to one of her shows, and I was 37 and I had spent my entire life thinking that I was really the only person such as myself in the entire world. Cause all the queer stuff I tried to access before that, it was either like party circuit stuff or it was, you know, like the respectable gays who thought that people like me were making the rest of them look bad. I never found
it. Yeah. Like that gay couple that, that supported Trump.
Those people.
I want to talk a little bit about the idea of suffering and yeah. people not understanding what that feels like.
I know it well. what do you want to talk about?
Well, I guess, you know, I want sort of to hear in your own words, what are we not understanding? Is it that the house is on fire and you're just trying to like put it out with cups of water and you're living in it? Or, I mean, is there an emergency thing or you're just, is there a situation where you're just like, can you describe the state of mind that you're in when you're overwhelmed?
Yeah. Are you talking about being disabled or are you talking about the suffering I went through in terms of not being welcome anywhere in the queer community for most of my life?
Well, we understand.
Because that was a lot of suffering too.
We understand the being a stranger in a strange land from, you know, watching reruns of H.R. Puffin stuff. I think this is something that really, and this is a common thing that I hear people talk about. When you talk about a disability, when you talk about a calamity, the first thing that comes out of their mouth is, how did this happen? What's happening? What did you do? Why don't you try this solution? And I said, it's like, you know, the worst thing about having cancer is talking about it.
Right. You know? And I would imagine having to console people when, you know, you're the person who actually has it is consoling the other person who's just like distraught to discover that you have it. But let's see, in my own words, for me, it's, I will briefly say that what happened was I was horribly misprescribed a medication that caused just devastating neurological problems. Like I literally could have died. And I obviously,
I'm not asking you for the causes and stuff. I'm talking
about
the mindset. Well, no,
but it's part of the explanation though, is that it was so hard to live for so long. But what was so difficult is that I don't look disabled. Like I don't have the visual cue of like a wheelchair or crutches, or I'm not dragging an IV around for me. And I think that honestly, the hardest part for me was not having people believe me that I'm sick, or maybe they could internalize like, oh, Gwendolyn's disabled, but they're not like understanding that that means like, no, literally I can't do this thing, or it's dangerous for me to be in this situation. Because one of the huge problems I had was, I mean, I had like several dozen some different neurological symptoms at the worst point, but having extreme difficulty thinking, and the fact that I'm fairly well spoken, you know, it makes me sound like I'm thinking more clearly than I'm not. It would be very hard to get people to understand that, like, I can't navigate my way through certain very basic situations. Like, I know I literally need you to help me get into a cab so I can get home because it's difficult for me to figure out the process of how do I get a cab. I mean, I know it sounds like ridiculously simple. You hail a cab or you use a rideshare app or something, but there would be times where, you know, I would look good. I would be dressed up to go out, but I would have a very difficult time navigating my way. And it's just so, and I would feel so sick on top of that. And, you know, and be coping with physical pain and all these other alarming symptoms. It was this constant having to negotiate. Is it safe for, I can't stand not going out, but I don't know if it's safe for me to go out in this condition. And I'm just very lucky to live relatively centrally to everything. So it wasn't like a long journey. I actually live on the same street a lot of the clubs are on, although I'm a little further up, but it's a real, it's like a straight shot. The bus goes there.
So when you say you're having a hard time navigating, is it like you're having a hard time like seeing on the app? You're trying, you're like, it's hard for you to kind of like make your way to the car?
It's just thinking. Well, there's the physical aspects, but I mean, when I'm really mentally affected, it's just hard to it's so hard to explain, but it's just like, it's hard to think. It's just really hard
you're
to
like
think and understand how things work. Yeah, cognitive fogging is actually what it's called, and cog fog for short.
Cog fog.
And so it's hard for other people to relate, and so they just go and snap out of it, or, you know,
right,
are you drunk?
And, you know, what did or you have you tried not being
idea.
Disabled? Yeah, or you
I
just need to go for a walk.
I don't want what happened to you
or,
to happen to me, yeah. So I'm going to put the responsibility on you and say, what did you do? Why aren't you taking care of yourself? You know, it's back to this idea. And then as Americans, we jump to this all the time, you know? You're wearing a sexy dress. That's why
you were
assaulted.
We're very blame-oriented, and so I got that some in the beginning. I think at this point, just... I think it helps that I wasn't like an active member of the queer community. I really only found my niche in the queer community 6 years ago, but I became disabled 8 years ago. So there was sort of this 2 year period where I was like a full tilt punk rock and roller. And I don't know if the queer community, I think, is a lot more sensitive and understanding and accepting. And I mean, there's so many, you know, we have such trouble accessing quality healthcare and everything. I feel like, you know, health problems are enough of a common thread, and also people are just a lot more sensitive and open and understanding in the queer community. It's I haven't had so many problems with them, and maybe times are just changing too. Maybe if I were to go back to the same people I was hanging out with 8 years ago, who were a bit more judgmental about it, I wouldn't get the same reaction. But that was just how the order I experienced things in.
Well, one positive thing about all this is that it allows you to be a curator of amazing erotic art, and you write beautifully about it on Tumblr, which the Sword of Damocles is hanging over its head. You know,
they're taking some queer content down.
Yeah, I'm glad that your stuff is up there. Yeah, Tumblr's in trouble. So definitely back it up. Make copies of it, because it could go down, and I'm not joking, like in weeks. So
okay. Noted.
You know, just go to your website, go to your Tumblr page, and just at the very least, there's like apps that you can do this, or just print it as a PDF. So at least you get something out of it, you know, because it would be the most heartbreaking. Remember when Vine went down? And everybody was scrambling to get their videos off of it.
Aww. How'd you get into blogging about erotic art?
Right. Well, that actually came from being disabled, because I, like I said, I mean, I was going through some really intense physical suffering, and I really was completely, I spend a lot of, most of my life, you know, in or on my bed, and I just couldn't do much. This is before I was really able to start actively performing, and I was just trying to find something to do to pass the time, and I'd always loved erotic art history. And, actually, the thing that got the ball rolling was a friend of mine named R.C. Cola, who has become the has been the host of the Poo Poo Platter, which is Austin's, you know, old, one of our alternative drag shows.
Yeah,
she's great.
Girls.
Right. And anyway, she had her own cable access show with another person for 10 years. And then that finally came to an end. And she started this thing called the Oracola, where people could call in and she'd read their tarot over the phone on public access. But the problem with that is it's great if a lot of people call in. But for a show, a half hour show where no one calls in or one person calls in, that is a hell of a lot of time to kill. So what she would normally do is try and have like a, you know, a creative type on the show with her so she should have someone to talk to. And she told me that Austin Public Access was completely censorship free, and I wanted to, as soon as I heard those words, I wanted to take the ball absolutely as far as I possibly could, you know, and run with it. And so I thought the most subversive thing I could do was to have big meaty cocks going into assholes and then lecture on it to about the, you know, how it's socially and artistically and historically significant. So I started with Tama Finlan, then I moved into Weimar Berlin, and then I ended on Edo Japan.
Well, considering a lot of these works of art have graphic sex acts depicted, mm-hmm. and genital nudity, how are they able mm-hmm. to be on television?
Just because public access, well, as long as it was during the safe harbor hours, which for them started after 10 p.m., they just did not regulate it. The only two things that they would not allow you to do were to have any sort of a logo, because they didn't want anyone to use their public access slot as essentially like a free infomercial, and you were not allowed to have live sex acts on the air, which I'm told someone actually put to the test by having someone give a silhouetted blowjob behind a lit curtain or something. But, and I think they got in trouble or, you know, they got a rap on the wrist. But I mean, like, what the hell are you going to do to someone? I mean, they didn't get fined or anything. They were just like, don't do it again. So,
Awesome cable access has always been such a zoo. And I don't mean this lightly. Right. Alex Jones got his start. And so did I.
Yeah.
Our shows were net back to back.
Back to back. Yeah, you said. That, and I always got such a kick out of hearing that. I remember his public access show because that was still on when I moved here.
Yeah, he was completely. He started out very kind of bland, and the ball just grew and started rolling and rolling and rolling.
Right.
You know?
Right. I remember when the first time I caught his show, he was talking about legalizing pot, and I'm like, oh yeah, all right, that sounds cool. And then all of a sudden he went off on like some, you know, Obama birth certificate or whatever, and I'm like, okay, nope.
Well, there were some really great amazing personalities in cable access around the country for people who don't realize what this phenomena was. And the advent of cable television, the FCC, the very liberal FCC said you have to set aside some channels and airtime for public access to give the public access to the television waves and make it cost accessible, right? So people didn't have to spend a lot of money to create their TV shows. Uh-huh. And so they had workshops and equipment and blue screens and all that stuff. And so, you know, cable access really was the early days of YouTube and video blogging.
Yeah.
And one extraordinary woman on cable access was Livia Live, who people who are familiar with, she was a legend in her time and very similar to Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Mm-hmm. Just this beautiful, mysterious goth woman sitting on a couch and just yelling at men with her stupid sex questions till 3 in the morning. You know, and she, outside of that, she was a chemical engineer at the University of Texas.
Oh, wow.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, she was an extraordinary person and a legend in her own time. And that was what's so great about, you know, Austin is just, it's just this, you know, passion and love for kooks and creative people. And you know, and I have some photos. I'm not sure the photos that I took of your home. You have this wonderful collection of rock and roll posters.
Yes, in the living room, because I didn't feel welcome in the queer community for most of my life, so I just threw myself head first into punk rock and rock and roll, and I feel like a lot of people talk about, oh, I'm so punk rock, but I mean, I mean, punk rock as in, I went to like dozens upon, like, I actually have a diary of all the shows I went to, and I was going to like 50 plus shows sometimes in the 60s a year for over 20 years. And I mean, I lived and breathed live performances. I mean, it wasn't all rock, but most of it was, and I especially loved punk. And interestingly, that was where I found more queer people that I liked than in the actual queer scene, because that's where all the other, you know, queer misfits and weirdos who the respectable gays thought were making everyone else look bad tended to filter. There have been so many high-profile queer and gender non-conforming people in rock and roll, and Lux Interior from the Cramps is, like, my all-time favorite, mm-hmm. and, I mean, like, Jane County and... I don't know. I'm drawing a blank, but there have been so many others, and
sure.
It was so
Jane
County,
who the character of Hedwig in The Angry Inch allegedly is based off uh-huh. of, but both parties in question go back and forth whether they how much they borrowed and what they borrowed off of it. Right. Last time we interviewed Jane County on the show, she was like, whatever.
Mm-hmm. He ripped me off. She,
you know, but yeah, it is a situation, and we, right, you know, I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but a similar phenomenon is happening to a friend of ours who is a drag legend and a unlicensed similar show like Whoa. Hedwig and the Angry Aww. Inch, maybe stealing every detail of this person's life.
Oh.
But this is coming in the spring, and
we don't know.
This details. Is some hot tea, right. people. And when we load it out for you, you're gonna your wig's gonna pop off. Uh-huh. We don't know. This is a speculation. It may not be true. That's why I don't
right.
feel comfortable bringing it out yet.
But, time you know, will tell.
Time will tell. You know, and it's like you know, I know we're running out of time. I want to quickly touch on the Austin International Drag Festival this
yes.
year with Camp Waikiki.
Uh-huh.
Our gal yep. pals, the Sugar Baker Twins.
Right. I got to meet them. I spoke to Cherry Pie in particular throughout the festival. I guess we met on the very first night, which was the Drag King. The King Fest, although they were drag king performances scattered throughout the show, but that was like a dedicated showcase. And so I met the Sugar Bakers that night, and then I just kept seeing them because I went to, you know, I participated in the festival 4 days, so I kept seeing around. And we chatted about you too, by the way, and they love you.
I got a quiz for you. So the yes. Sugar Baker Twins are the hosts of Camp Waikiki, where uh-huh. 8 drag queens compete to be the queen of camp. And in right. real life, they are actual twins who run uh-huh. the Hamburger Mary's chain of restaurants. Uh-huh. And everyone has no idea which one's which.
I
so
got
one
the
has
cheat,
a beehive
cheat.
And the other one has a bouffant.
No. There's all right, this is how I could tell, at least. I don't know if this is something she always does, but Cherry pointed out that she wears glasses, I think little cat's eye glasses, and they have little cherries on the corner.
Oh, that's
well,
so
that would
cute.
Help. And
yeah, it was incredibly helpful.
Brandon is the one who is not wearing the beehive, and he is Cherry Pie. And Ashley does not have... Ashley is the one with the beehive, and Ashley is Apple Brown Betty.
Correct. A mm-hmm. for Ashley, Apple Brown Betty, and then Cherry Pie is the science, the organic chemist, the one who knows math and science, and that's why she has Cherry Pie as in the symbol for the square root, the ratio right. between the circumference and the radius of a circle.
How was the Austin International Drag
Because she's irrational.
What were some of the highlights for you for this year?
Yeah, it was great. I just, for the listeners, I made a playlist of 20 videos I shot because I had an HD camera on me to record my own 2 performances. And then I was like looking around me like, why would I not keep recording this stuff?
So you want to enjoy the show? you know, because some people are like, I'll come to a drag show and people are like, Mark, do you mind recording the show for me? I'm like, I came to watch the right. show, not work.
Yeah, I often feel that way, but I feel like I go to shows without recording them mm-hmm. the very overwhelming majority of the time. So once in a while when I know there's going to be like some just amazing stuff that I know for a fact I will want to go back and be able to have the luxury of rewatching, you know, for as many times as I want, then I'll, on those occasions, especially if I like have the camera on me anyway, because I recorded myself, then I'll go ahead and do that. So if I've made a playlist, if people out there want to look up Austin International Drag Fest 2018 playlist. But my highlights, obviously the Dragula girls were amazing. Certainly out of people I was looking forward to seeing, James Majesty, Ursula Major, and Erica Clash were just amazing. I got videos of them on there. In particular, James did this sex bot routine that I just thought was fantastic. Plus, they were doing a laser show, which just was perfect, you know, a backdrop for James's routine. And then Ursula did a Edward Scissorhands thing, which was just great. And Erica Clash had this really visually stunning black light Night of the Living Dead routine. And out of people who I just didn't even know their name before I saw them on the stage, the real standout is with Sean Benet, and that's Sean S-H-A-W-N Benet. And it turns out they're only from San Antonio. I can see them whenever I want to.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
so excited.
What were their performances
apparently,
like?
I got one recorded. And this was my favorite thing from the whole festival. And the thing about it was just this intensive genderfuck mad energy, just the way they moved their body. They were performing to Aja's Finisher, and with a Super Mario Brothers twist to it. You'd have to watch the video, but they were just, I don't know, their body movements and their energy and their attitude. It's hard to translate, so I would just tell people to look up the video, but it was a huge amount of fun. And Geneva Convention also did a great Kathy Griffin routine, and I can't even do it justice. My own, I might add, I thought were pretty good. I did a performance called Piece of Meat, which is about, it was like a Full Tilt storyline, although obviously kept simple because it's only four and a half minutes, but it was about a harassed waitress who gets her revenge. And then I performed to the Cramps TV set, which I love the Cramps.
I love the
so
Cramps
much.
Too.
And, yeah, and it's I did it as an homage to two of my favorite horror movies, being Frozen Terror and Cemetery Man, both of which involve someone keeping a severed head that they're having amorous relationship with around. So for people who do not know, the song TV set is about someone who keeps a severed head in a TV and uses the eyeballs for dolls is one of the lines. And so I actually made this huge, elaborate cardboard prop TV set with Christmas lights inside, and I got this glam rock painted, you know, severed head. And the storyline I did for that, because it has a couple of instrumental pieces, so mainly I was acting out the lyrics, and then for the instrumental part, you know, I made out with the head.
Ooh.
And then, you know, it performs oral sex on me, and then I put it back on the TV, and then for the next instrumental thing, I make out with it again, but it eats my ass, and then as I turn around to kiss it, because if someone eats your ass, I think the least you can do is kiss them afterwards, but as I go back to kiss it, it actually bites my neck, and, you know, I had, like, a blood thing rigged to go off, and then I die at the end of the song, and that's the end, and... Yeah, like I should.
Your own version of a death drop.
Right.
I'm not posting that video. Drag queens are mad at a club because they don't want people voguing because it's too violent.
Well,
I saw that post. I don't think it was violent, but they're claiming some sort of bullshit sounding liability thing, but without hearing the original thing, I don't know.
To me.
It totally
yeah,
sounds
it does.
Right.
It's
Although
incredibly
I have to say,
racist,
listen, if
true.
You're going to slay.
Right, that wasn't here in Austin, by the way. That's in Cleveland.
Yeah.
But I was just, I think we were reading the same Facebook post earlier today.
What do you think about, you know, this idea that drag queens, when they photograph themselves, should not be retouching their photos when they post it on social media?
Who says
that? Why not?
That? Oh my God. You've been missing out. It's this, that, this term. I know. And I'm like, but drag is all about artifice. So the Photoshop aspect is just
Photoshop
one
aspect.
Who is one of the greatest, who is the greatest drag makeup artists of all time?
And photo retoucher.
Who is that?
Let's ask Sweet Gwendolyn.
Quiz. Oh, I don't know. There's so many good ones out there. I couldn't pick a favorite.
I would have to say it's Matthew Anderson.
Correct.
And yeah, Matthew, that would, honestly, that's where my mind went. Yeah.
But. And he said, if you want good drag photos, do good makeup, but also use Photoshop.
Use Photoshop, right. Well, the reason you have to do that on some levels is just the nature of photography. Sometimes the lighting bleaches out the color, and so you have to go in and tweak the vibrance so it looks like it actually does if you were in the same room looking at the person.
Yeah, and you know, I've had drag queens complain that I retouch my photos.
Your own photos or your photos of them?
I said, well, I'd be happy to post the photos that I took of you without retouching them.
And then they're like, oh, no, that's okay.
That conversation ended real fast.
Yep.
I put a lot of time and energy into making people look good. And myself, too.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know? And listen, what God can't give you, the computer can too.
They model, they Photoshop 13-year-old girls masquerading as women in these magazines. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
And I have to compete with that.
And I want to, and this changed for me with the blue. You remember that blue, black, gold, white dress controversy? Is it a blue, black dress? Is it gold?
Oh,
white?
Yes. Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
And for me, the way people were so passionately talking about that dress color as, you know, Protestants and Catholics fighting to the death over the same religion.
Basic religion, right?
It's the religion of the dress, the fashion and photography. It made me realize that photography is a very powerful tool. And, you don't have to dream it. You can be it and let that camera do some of the heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to retouch your face. It's okay to wear a wig or, cinch it a little. Use that Liquify tool, honey. It's like, I'll stop when you stop.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely, I consider Photoshop to be just a post-production part of the makeup process. I mean, especially if I'm doing my own edits, then it's still me, painting my face. Although honestly, I don't really change much when I edit. Almost everything I do is just brightening it up and doing some, tweaking the colors so that they look more like they did in real life, or maybe even, a little brighter. But I mean, sometimes there are little things where you like see a spot or just something like that. But I just try to enhance what's there.
I blame Beyonce for all this.
Why?
Uh-huh.
She said, she posted on Instagram, I woke up looking like this.
Well, because she had a bunch of people doing her makeup for her and her hair.
Yeah,
she
laid in the chair and she fell asleep. Take a nap.
You know? Right. And like when she says she woke up like this, she really means I woke up like this. You know?
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had to take a nap in drag?
What?
Have you ever had to take a nap in drag? Yeah.
Oh, no. I've never been able to nap. I've never been much of a napper. I'm just either I'm up or I'm out,
Girl, I gotta tell you, when I was dressed up as a bear for Camp Wanakiki, we started really at the crack of dawn, and I was, then later we were doing the judging in the evening, and I didn't want to like take all that off and then put it back on. So
right,
I was like,
of course,
and it was a long day. I was like, I'm gonna take a nap in the bear glitter beard and the bear suit and all that stuff.
I know queens that have had a full night's sleep in drag because they're like, I have to be up in the morning.
I
want to
know what
drag,
your pillow looks like.
You know, you just have to you just readjust. You know,
I was terrified of smearing my makeup like Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie.
Right. Well, just use a lot of fixer.
Well, I just basically put the pillows next to my head, and it was almost like I was, in a cart, like in a neck brace to keep my head from rotating.
From turning, yeah.
What advice would you give to the organizers of the Austin International Drag Festival? You're a big fan. You're such a lifeblood of the festival. What kind of loving guidance can you give them to keep it awesome and have it continue to go?
Well, they're actually really good friends of mine. I talk to them. I give them my perspective on the festival all the time. I mean, honestly, this year was by far the smoothest, this being the fourth year. One thing that they did really right was which was not my suggestion. They figured it out on their own. But in the past, it was really the schedules were all over the place. And the reason for that is they'd allot 10 minutes for each performer. But most performers were in the 5 minutes give or take slot. So instead, they just wrote the schedules out this year, allotting everyone five. In reality, you can go longer than that, but on average, they just figured everyone's going to take around 5 minutes, and then suddenly it became a lot more predictable what time everyone was going on the stage. And the other thing that was so nice is that because, of course, it's a grassroots operation, it's like 100% volunteer. I think all the way up to the top, it's completely all volunteer. And it's just what happens when you have a bunch of people who are, good-hearted and they want to do a great thing, but they don't know how to do it yet. Well, now that this is the fourth one, people who didn't have, you know, any experience going into it have gotten so much better and making it happening. And I mean, that's all the way down to the bottom, just like people who hadn't stage managed before, or, you know, just hadn't done, stagehand work or just whatever their function was. There are a lot of returning volunteers, and then people who are new are volunteers are more likely to be people who are already have professional experience, and they've heard about this really cool festival that sounds like a lot of fun, and they want to lend their talents. So I would say everything about the festival was a much smoother experience. I mean, that's not saying it didn't have some things to iron out, but I think the biggest problem was it wasn't their fault at all, which was that last year it was three clubs literally next door to each other, which was really convenient, but one of them closed, so had two stages.
Who closed?
Sidewinder, which was the one that had two stages,
so
the front room and the back room. So next year, I'm sure a new club will have opened up in that space and they can probably use it again. But instead, they had to do Valhalla, which was right across the street from Elysium and Beerland, and Scratch House, which was around the corner. And because, of course, everyone's wearing high heels and going around a corner and across the street is a little bit of a stroll when your shoes aren't comfortable. I think Scratch House didn't have as many people in it. Nearly Elysium was where the major party was at. And they also said at the closing party, they added a Sunday night showcase as well as a huge closing party. They said that it was the most successful festival they'd had so far. Now, I don't know what the metric was that they were measuring that by, but I would say attendance seemed definitely pretty solid.
That's great. That's great to hear. I'd love to see that it's growing.
Mm-hmm. Sweet Gwendolyn, it's always nice catching up with you. Debbie Penetration.
Likewise. I love you guys so much, and I can't wait till we see each other next.
Your stage name is, in this case, you know, because it's Mark and I with you.
What?
Yes.
No, because there's double. Yes, one for each end.
Right.
Someone explain that to me, like the experience of being interviewed by a gay couple.
Mm-hmm.
Is sort of like, you know, doing a porn or something.
Double penetration.
Yeah. And I was just like, I don't know if that's what I would say, but I don't know. You tell me.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, I don't know. It was a fun and easy experience, but I guess you can say that about double penetration with the right people, too. So
I wouldn't know. Well, thank you, sweet Gwendolyn, Debbie Penetration. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, it was my pleasure. All right. I'll talk to you guys later.
Talk to you later.
All right.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Sweet Gwendolyn lives in Austin, Texas. You can visit her art gallery of erotic art on Tumblr through the link on our website, feastoffun.com.
And you can find her profile for Debbie Penetration on facebook.com/DebbiePennyATX.
Just follow the image of Homer Simpson in drag as Divine, covered in donuts and dog poop. The filthiest queen ever.
I want to remind folks, we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, consider signing up today at feastoffun.com/plus.
Let us know what you think about, you know, the changing face of gender nonconforming performance, drag, LGBT clubs, queer spaces. And is television doing a good job at representing that? Or are they have some... Lucy, you have some explaining to do. You got some homework to do. Let us know. Are we just putting too much demand on RuPaul's Drag Race, or RuPaul's Drag Race can do better? Let us know on our comments, feastoffun.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.